You're listening to the Comicast. I'm Liam. On June the 18th, 2011, myself and Craig were guests at Squarebound, an Irish comics creators convention. While we were there, we recorded several panel discussions. The following is a panel where Jerry Hunt is interviewed by Squarebound organiser Pádraic O'Maoláid.
This is Jerry Hunt, comics artist, writer, creator. What do you want to be called?
I'm a retired individual.
You retired
from my job when I was 50.
Did you?
I did.
And you were an architect.
I was, yeah, but that's all way in the past. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted to draw comics. Uh-huh. Because I've been reading comics since way before I could read. Uh-huh. I used to have a cousin, and if anybody has heard this before, it's the story I trot out to give people an idea of how it started. I used to have a cousin. I was reared in Sligo, even though I'm a Dub. And I had a he wasn't a cousin, he was a friend. And he had relations in America, and they used to send him a big bundle of comics every month. And when the comics would arrive, he'd come up to our house, he'd just tap on the door, stick his head around the door, and nod, and I knew the comics had arrived. And we'd spend the whole morning reading comics. I couldn't read at the time, I was only about 4 or 5. And it was terrific, and that's how I got to know all about Dick Tracy, Educate, and Archie, and all those people. And they all had the same sort of an ending, but for me it was terrific. But from that day on, I was hooked. Mm. And when I got a few pence pocket money, I used to buy me own.
What sort of year was this?
Oh,
roughly.
God. it would be back in the early 40s.
Okay, because I mean the American comics
the
really
early 40s.
Started.
I don't mind saying no, I'm 75 years old. I mean, for God's sake, everybody knows that.
I wasn't going to ask, it was
in 1942 or so.
Yeah, because I mean I'm just trying to see where
we're
the
all
American
comics were everywhere.
Yeah.
And we had absolutely no comics here in Ireland. Mm. Although they did get some British comics in. I used to buy then the Radio Fun.
Yeah,
and it used to come on the bus from Dublin, and I waited outside. In actual fact, the comics were sold in a chemist shop where I was reared in Ballymote in Sligo, and I waited for my Radio Phone every week. I had sixpence pocket money, tuppence for the Radio Phone, fourpence for the matinee on Sunday, and that was you made your own fun for the rest of the week. And we lived in the country, and it was terrific.
Yeah,
everybody was in the same boat. We had no money. Nobody had any money. And my problem was that going to a country school and in secondary school afterwards and even up to Bolton Street, there were no art classes. I was never at an art class.
Did you study art? I mean, if you were an architect, there must have been some.
There was some,
sort of
yeah, but that was mainly to do with buildings.
Yeah.
They would teach you a bit about still life.
Yeah.
So you sketched all the statues, the classical statues, back from the Renaissance times and that.
Yeah.
And that was the bit, but that was only for 1 hour a week.
Mm.
So there was no art as such.
So you're self-taught, then?
I was self-taught because I started drawing when I was about 5. When I started drawing comics, I started drawing, and the first things I used to draw were some of the comics were about a fella called Bill Boyd, Hopalong Cassidy. And I won a quiz in a pub in the Hut one evening. One of you'd what was Hopalong Cassidy's horse's name? No, you tell me that.
Oh dear God, no, I'm not going to tell you. It wasn't Hoss. No, it was
Topper.
Well, there's
Gene Autry was champion, Roy Rogers was Trigger, and Hopalong Cassidy was Topper.
Very good.
And nobody knew that except me. And that's a bit of useless information for you. But I started drawing. I remember what fascinated me was that the Stetson that the cowboys wore, and the way it turned up like that, and the way the artists in the comic could do it that way and do it that way, with just a few changes in lines. And I used to draw, I could draw these hats with my eye closed. And Dick Tracy was another one. Because the art in those days, in the comics, it was the most basic.
Mm.
It was absolutely basic, because in America, the comics were all for kids.
Well, I think one of the other reasons,
for grown-ups.
One of the other reasons was they were printing it on very poor paper. And if it wasn't just very simple lines, it'd all just blur into nothing. You know?
Well, the thing is, what a lot of the comics were sold to the newspapers.
Mm, yeah.
Because what happened was the newspaper came maybe at the weekend, the husband took the main page, whatever the wife took, and he handed the back page to the kids
yeah.
to keep them quiet, because that was the comics page.
Yeah.
And but all the comics in America in those days were for kids. They were for nobody mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. Kids. In fact, when I started...
I'm very sorry about this.
That's all right.
When
I started drawing, when I decided I wanted to draw comics, I took early retirement. As soon as I hit 50, I said, that's it, I have enough of the work. I'm a bachelor, I don't have a mortgage,
mm-hmm.
I have a small pension, and I spent 10 years teaching myself how to draw. 10 years. I could always draw, but I had to be prepared to bring it up to another level. And I used to buy comics, and I'd be looking and checking to see was mine as good as that. And when I thought that I was getting there, I produced one called The Three Lovely Lassies from Cabra. And I gave it around to my friends.
Mm.
And the reaction was positive enough. So based on that, then, I produced Streets of Dublin.
Streets of Dublin, right.
Yeah, which was... it was based on an old poem that my father used to recite way back, an American poem called Dangerous Dan McGrew. I don't know if everybody,
yes.
if anybody ever heard of Dangerous Dan McGrew.
Now, was that Robert had, Service?
It was about was a game of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Dangerous Dan McGrew, the kid that handled the music box was playing a ragtime tune. And back at the bar in the solo game was Dangerous Dan McGrew. And watching his love, watching the play with his life of love, the lady that's known as Lou. And
now, before you go any further, hang on, I'm going to
well,
we get back to this. But since you mentioned Streets of Dublin and all of that, some of the things that it's obvious to me looking at your art in that, the things that influence you, or things that you like that are obviously Western movies.
Yes.
Very much so.
Yes, very much.
Robert Crumb comics.
Yes.
I mean...
at the start, I'm sort of gone off Robert Crumb.
Oh, yes, okay.
I couldn't help feeling... I mean, Robert Crumb is famous, and good luck to him for being famous. But if Robert Crumb wasn't drawing the type of stuff he's drawing, would he be as famous? I don't know.
I know what you mean, the underground stuff that he did. I mean,
it's pretty... Fellas masturbating and you see the result of their masturbating. That's fine, like, if it tells a story, but if it's only a guy thinking,
yeah,
is there a need for it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm open-minded, but I'm just wondering, would he be as famous?
Yeah, well,
as well
I think he was... The time that he was doing that kind of stuff and all the undergrounds that break through, they're trying to break through all of the taboos, it was of its time, I think, as well.
It probably was, yeah. Well, people were so fed up... I suppose it was because people were so fed up with the children comics image and that fellas back from the war back in the late 40s and 50s that wanted to draw, they had seen an awful lot.
Yeah.
They had relations who were coming back maybe without legs or coming back alcoholics, coming back drug addicts, and all from their experiences, woeful experiences. They wanted to draw about things as they were.
Yeah.
And that's what brought Crumb in. And, you know, I'm not condemning Crumb.
Mm.
I like his style.
Yeah. It's just a certain...
I
know,
like
early
his style,
on.
And I would certainly... if I saw something that I could use out of a comic, I'd nick it. And very quick. And I'd make no apologies about it. And I'd say most guys would, whether they're singers or guitar players or anything. That's what you do. I mean, you get influenced.
Mm. But the singing, actually, since you mentioned it, there's a very strong sort of folk ballad element to the construction.
Well, you see, the thing is, I only knew the first verse of Dangerous Dan McGrew, but the comic, you won't make much of a comic on one verse, so I had to rewrite the other.
Mm.
I remember sitting in Barcelona airport waiting for a flight back here. I'd been away on a few days' holidays, and I just scribbled it out bit by bit,
mm-hmm.
and that's what took the thing. And I started before I was even halfway through a story. I never have a story when I'm drawing a comic,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the things that pisses me off about publishers. They insist on having a story. I mean, who needs a story? I mean, when I wake up in the morning, I don't know what's going to happen today.
Mm-hmm.
You have an idea of what's going to happen. But things could happen. So and this is how I did one I'm doing now, and this is how I did Streets of Dublin and the one Streets of Dublin 2. You base it on an idea, you have an idea, but how are you going to tackle it? You don't know until you sit down and you start drawing. And maybe you could change that before you're, maybe you go back and say, maybe I should have changed that page. Whereas if you were with a publisher, and the people I'm with, O'Brien Press, they're excellent, but you've got to have the full story, and it's got to be, and we don't like that bit now, could you change that? And they were even asking me, instead of working away on my art, I had given them the story, and I said, well, that's my bit done with O'Brien Press. Then they started saying, well, could you send us in roughs for the next 30 pages? And I says, no way am I doing that. Because, again, what I'm thinking, if I want to approach a page, and this is what your brain is doing all the time, if you're living for comics the way I live for them, by the time you get to page 10 of the 30 that you've sent them in or that they've approved, you might have a totally different idea for doing that particular page. Something might have struck you in the pub or someplace. Yeah, if I got them coming in from that side, or if I got someone else coming in with the gun or whatever, I might change the whole thing. So that's the way I like to be. It's not that I was being smart or being sort of, I couldn't care less about children. I do care about them because they're terrific. Publishers are brilliant when it comes to publishing your work, selling your work, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, they have a much greater outreach than you're
absolutely
ever going to have.
I mean,
publishing it yourself.
The first time I produced a comic in Dublin, I was asking someone like Rob Corley, who was at it for a while, how many prints would I need? And he was saying, what do you think yourself? Well, I said, would I need 1,000? And he laughed at me. He says, if you sell 1,000 copies of a comic in Dublin, says he, or here in Ireland, it'll be the greatest miracle of all time. And he was suggesting sort of like 500 prints, or because you can get them cheaper for more or less the same, you can get 750 for almost the same price as 500. The only problem is that if you get 750 and they don't sell, you've got 5 or 6 bloody boxes on top of the 5 or 6 boxes from the last comic, and they start building up space in your room, and that's the way things go. So Brian, a publisher changes all that.
Now, before you start talking about O'Brien all the time, I'm trying to lead you through this in some sort of chronological order. So the first thing you published, you self-published...
was in Dublin City.
In Dublin City.
Yeah.
And right. Which you first of all, I think you had it photocopied or something like that, wasn't it? Or you had
I got 25 copies done in Hackett's.
Mm.
They photocopied them and I stapled them together myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a cover myself. And I brought them down to Kevin in the Forbidden Planet, mm-hmm. and I asked him would he put them on the shelf. And I didn't want him to be putting them where, up until then, they had a little wire cage where they had Irish comics, mm-hmm. with the thing written in longhand in a marker, Irish comics. And the standard was pretty bad.
Yeah, just true enough.
The standard, because they're done by lads, probably with no money, but they had right ideas, but they were young and they didn't really have it. So I didn't really want to be put there now, and I'm not being snobbish or anything like that, but I felt that I had got a slightly better standard. And I was delighted when they were put up on the shelves beside all the Marvel comics and all that. And I think it was Bob Byrne was saying the same, that when he got his put up, it's a great sense.
In a very short space of time there, that was about 2001, 2002,
it would be, yeah,
something like that. First issue, your first comic in Dublin City, and I think I bought in Sub City. I remember going in. I think you had walked out the door, and I'd walked in and bought a copy. And Bob Burns, not Shiznit, the other thing.
Clam nuts.
Oh, please somebody tell me. Sorry, Mbleh. Thank you.
That's it. Yeah,
that's, yes,
Mbleh. Yeah,
the 5-issue project that he only published 3 issues of, but however.
Yeah.
But I mean, suddenly what had previously been done, we're all just little cheap, badly produced, badly done,
Byrne brought them to
and
a new level.
And yourself and Bob and Robert Corley have been doing some stuff.
Yeah.
And then
we got Alan Nolan,
the first issue of Sancho. And suddenly
it was like overnight, the standard just blew up.
Yeah,
it
and
blew
every time
up
some,
overnight,
every time Woody brought out something,
pardon?
Every time Woody brought out something, it meant the bar went up a little further.
It
was, you know?
Was because and it was terrific. So we followed that one up with In Dublin City Too, which was based on another song that any of you that's into the folk music, a great friend of mine called Frank Hart, unfortunately Frank is no longer with us, he used to sing a song which he called the something sailor. I call it Johnny Doyle, and we based it on that, about a woman that goes off to see after her man to look after the kid. But that was the next one.
Mm.
So then we went for Streets of Dublin, and this time I was getting a bit ambitious, and I says, I'll do it in full colour. The other ones were all in black and white. This one in full colour, and I got in Bren B, who was a terrific colourist, a young man, half my years. And that's the first time I heard the word graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at it, I says, here's a comic I want you to colour. Would you be interested in colouring? He says, see, that's a graphic novel. And I says, what's a graphic novel? So he explained to me. So then I knew what a graphic novel was. And people, to me, they're comics.
Yeah.
They're comics. Because what happened with the graphic novel, and you probably know this, there was a fellow called Richard Coyle in America back in the 60s. He was a publisher. And he saw these being produced in Europe, which were way ahead of anything that was going on in the States. They were graphic novels in all but name. They were for grown-ups, as well as for kids, but they were for grown-ups. And he says, this is brilliant, I'm going to bring some of these to America. But of course he had to put a name on them. And he first thought graphic story, no. There was a fellow called Will Eisner, who called them sequential art.
Mm-hmm.
But the name graphic novel stuck, and someone told me it's in the dictionary now or something like that.
Oh, dear, dear, dear,
but that's it now. But I have to say that in Europe they were at it for years.
All the band Disney stuff.
Well, anybody who ever comes across a book by Paul Gravett, who is a terrific critic, he does the critics for a lot of the comics in Comics International. He has a book called Graphic Novel, and he gives you all the information you want on that. It's a brilliant book, and he has pieces from them all. And if ever I want to sound knowledgeable on the subject, depending on who I'm talking to, I go back and I read a few pages out of Paul Gravett, and that gives me enough material for the whole night. It's a great novel, and it's well worth getting for anybody. It gives you great.
Yeah, I know the book. So how then you published In Dublin, not Dublin, Streets of Dublin.
Streets of Dublin, we published ourselves as well.
Yeah.
And
it was nice
that went very well. Mm. By this stage, we had taken the bull by the horns and we got on to Diamond Comics, who are very well-known distributors. And we got on to their London office. And they looked at it and they said, fine, send us so many copies.
Mm.
And they sold. And they sold well from Streets of Dublin, so they says, have you anything else coming up? Well, we have nothing else coming up because I'm very slow when it comes to drawing. Jeez, I was talking to Alan Dolan there.
Yeah, Alan is whipping it out there for
Alan,
a while now. Yeah.
It'll take me the best part of a week to do a page because I do backgrounds at all. Alan Dolan will do 5 pages in a day. He told me he did 7 pages in one day. Mm. That I was feeling getting smaller and smaller because this guy is quick and his standard is fantastic. But it takes me a long time to do a comic.
Mm.
I set myself out the best part of the year for a comic by the time it's printed and everything. So we followed it up, but we didn't have a comic, so we got Dublin City 1, Dublin City 2, we combined the two and we got them coloured by Bren B and printed, and they went fine. And it was at that stage that O'Brien Press came along.
How did you end up in contact with O'Brien Press? Did they just get in touch with you?
It was pure chance. There's a girl who works in O'Brien Press called Emma, and she's a designer for them. And Emma obviously likes comics,
mm-hmm.
or maybe purely. And she went into the Forbidden Planet, and she picked up a copy of Streets of Dublin,
mm-hmm.
and she brought it home and she read it, and she brought it into one of their weekly meetings, and she says, "Look, we should go into this graphic novel thing."
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done any before. They had done one with Bob Byrne, but it was a very small little one.
Oh, that was the Robots Don't Cry.
Small
kids
little thing. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to do a big one, so they came along and they gave me a call, and I went in with Bren B and we sat down, and up until that, we had been doing mostly fiction, and I had said to Brian Bigwin, "Oh, the next one, I would really like to do something on history. Something with a historical flavour." And he says, "What were you thinking of?" Well, I said I was thinking of 1913, the strike, the great lockout here in Dublin, with the independent newspapers and that. I said, that would be a great story. I think Joe, what's his name, Strumpet City, what do you call the guy that wrote
Plunkett.
Anyway, it was a great, it made a good film and everything. But I was thinking of that, and says, well, look, if you're going down that road, says, why don't you go the whole hog, he says, and do 1916? And I thought, well, that's brilliant. I said, that's a great idea. So we'll go for it. So then we got the call from O'Brien Press, and we sat down with Michael O'Brien and Ivan and the whole gang. He asked us, well, what were you thinking of doing next? We have this one, it's fiction, it's about Chinese drug gangs in Dublin, fine. But that's not really our scene. What are you thinking of doing? Well, I says, funny, we're going to change it from that. I says, we're going to do 1916. And they all started to smirk. I can only say smile, I suppose, politely.
No, smile.
I says, what's the joke? Well, they says, that's exactly what we were going to ask you to do.
Well, I remember thinking, I mean, once I became aware several years ago that 1916, the 100th anniversary, was kind of coming towards us a little, you know.
Yeah.
We said, whichever publisher did the 1916 graphic novel, was automatically onto a good thing.
Yeah.
And
I'm
very glad it was yourself got it, you know. And
well, funny enough, now I'm weird like that. When I think of doing something, I never sort of think of when 1916, the centenary is coming up. This will be, I sort of feel, would that be a good story to do? Would that be something I'd enjoy doing? And my father was in 1916, so I said, yeah, for him, if for nothing else. And that's why we... And Bren was the same. He wasn't thinking about sales and that.
Well, I mean, I just thought...
Yeah.
For them, obviously, it was a commercial.
Brian Press were all into that sort of thing, and good luck to them. That's their end of it. And the only problem, I would say, it's funny, our other two comics had gone well with Diamond in America and places like that. Mm-hmm. And they were coming back for more. But when Ivan O'Brien went to them with 1916, with the idea for 1916, and one or two of the pages, they wouldn't touch it. It says there were no superheroes. That there were none of this, that, and the other. And that's the way, they know, and that the Americans wouldn't really go for it. And it hasn't really gone in the States.
Was he not selling some of it by mail order, I think, out of the, you know, from the website?
Well, it's sold out, like, I don't know whether about five
the first
or six.
Print run sold out in something
it's
like two
it's
months
it's
or something.
A couple of months, and so they're on their second run now. Yeah. So I'm very happy with it. But I'm a little bit disappointed that when we were able to get Diamond Comics, they weren't able to get it, but that's neither here nor there, I suppose.
I would have thought the Americans would have loved.
Well, I would have thought too.
But there you are, who can tell?
Well, there's an exhibition of it on at the moment in Kilbenham Jail, and there are busloads going out every day, so I suppose the odd one will buy a copy.
I foresee it's the kind of thing that'll stay in print.
I hope so.
For a good long time.
So.
And the sales curve can only go up as we approach 2016, surely.
So.
You know? They'll hardly let it go out of print.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that was... O'Brien Press are the first mainstream Irish publisher to kind of publish a graphic novel. So I think it was also important from the point of view of...
Oh, absolutely.
..of anything that ever happened again, that it should be successful, so it's great that it was successful.
Well, O'Brien Press have actually gone overboard now. They've gone to the other extreme in that they've got 8 graphic novels coming out this year, which I'm very pleased about because... it means, I mean, I cannot stress it enough, the talent we have out there now, we can compare with any country now. Mm. All that's lacking is the history, you know, the culture of the thing.
Yeah.
But at the moment, we've got guys, I mean, there's a guy that I sat on the panel with there at the start of the year. I can't even remember his name. You'd remember him. He's from down around Dennis or someplace. And he's now working for Marvel Comics.
Oh, Declan Shalvey.
Declan Shalvey.
Yeah.
He's
Declan
for Marvel. Bob Byrne is working for 2000 AD. And it's terrific. I just love the way things are at the moment.
And I mean, Alan Nolan is... he's got something like he did a 5-book contract to do this series of.
Well, he's with O'Brien Press.
But with O'Brien,
that's the way it goes. But they asked me then, they were very pleased with 1916, and they asked me what had I coming up, had I anything else. Well, I had been working on one before they came along, and it's back to the old fiction stuff. It's about the Viking undead in Dublin, but it's called Draugr, D-R-A-U-G-R, about a Viking who's upset up in his grave, and it's one of the oldest graveyards in Dublin, and there's a man, and I'd love to see him in it, but not, that's neither here nor there, because it's only down the road from Bertie Ahern, but I don't want to get into that, but it's a lovely old graveyard, and I thought it would be ideal for to have this guy at rest when something comes along. Who, it's a follow-on from Streets of Dublin, and I really enjoyed doing it because it was a question of getting an idea and taking up the story as I went along. So O'Brien Press says, well, what have you got coming up? And I told him about this, and they said, oh, bring it in, we'll have a look. I said, you're not going to like it. I said, you're not going to like this, because they do schools work and stuff like that. No, bring it in. So I brought it in, and I haven't heard a word since. And that's about 6 months ago. Because you know, you're talking about Dublin inner city, the city that I live in, the north inner city. And I mean, you know, it's not as obvious to people who don't know the area, but I know where every lassie on the game lives. Not that I'm too old now for that sort of thing. Anyway, you don't ever pay for it in your own city, let's face it.
But, anyway.
it's a comic I love doing, and I'm just waiting to get someone to do a cover for me, because I want someone that's better known than myself to do the cover.
I wanted to, I was talking to Ivan, and I was saying there was something I wanted to do, something historical as well.
Yeah.
On this, and I said I'd love to do write a comic about the Monto.
Right.
The Monto, just around down the road here, which was one of the most famous and notorious red light areas in Europe in its day. And he was kind of going, well, we were kind of hoping to go for the school's audience, you know, the libraries. And I said, fair enough, so I'll pitch it somewhere else.
Well, I don't mind. I mean, I'm going ahead with this one, and I've got to produce it, and I hope that it does all right.
You're doing something else for O'Brien, though, are you? Are you doing the Lockout?
No. I'm not, and that could come down the road, but I'm doing the War of Independence now, which is a totally different thing to 1916. 1916 was very concise. You had 1 week, and it was just full of, and I thought I knew about 1916 after I started going into the National Library and reading up about it. There were things I didn't know at all.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Well, like some of the guys, I mean, I says, I'm going to, I wasn't there, I says, and I don't know these guys, and I don't like people writing about them. I mean, there is a guy, what's his name, Myers, and he writes in The Independent, and he seems to think Michael Collins was a thug, and he thinks that all the rest of them were thugs. Someone should give him enough money to buy a book about the auxiliaries and the black and tans, because they, you had to meet like with like, especially in the War of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm going to say about it. I wasn't there, so I just have to go on what I call second-hand information, which doesn't really sit well with me. But what else can you do when you're writing about something historical?
Mm.
What I do is I take so many different versions and what correlates and what seems to tie in one with the other, and I try to deal with the action. I would never write about a person's personality or this, because when you haven't met the guys, what can you say? In 1916, I deviated from that a bit, because there was one guy that really just appealed to me, something ferocious, and that was Joe Plunkett, the guy who was dying of TB, and he got married 2 hours before he was executed to Grace Gifford. And I was going to start 1916 with, the Yard, the German ship coming in full of arms, which the boys were relying on totally, and it was waylaid off, I don't know, was it Bantry or someplace in the south east coast, southwest coast, and the arms were all scuttled, so they had nothing. And Plunkett, I was going to start with that. I thought that would be a good dynamic first page to see the yard being told to heave to by some British patrol boat, and the Germans deciding, oh, we're going to scuttle the arms, so we send them to the bottom of the ocean. That'll be a great page. But coming through all the time was this Joe Plunkett and Grace Gifford. And I deviated by just letting the old heart overrule the head, and I start with the wedding of Joe Plunkett and Grace Gifford.
But you were right, yeah. I mean, I think you do need some sort of a person.
But I didn't know much about Joe Plunkett until I started doing up, and at the launch in Kilmainham I was delighted to meet his grandniece. She opened the launch, lovely person, and she knew all about loads of stuff that I had never heard about, and that sort of thing. And there were other people involved in that, fellas like Ned Daly, Aben Cant, that we never hear about. And if any of you ever want to write an adventure picture or story, and you want a superhero, forget Arnie, forget those, think about Cathal Brua. Cathal Brua down in the South Dublin Union, he was shot 15 times, and that is no exaggeration. All the books say that. Some say 12, some say 14, 15, 16, but he was shot and he recovered, and he went on to take part in the first government, and then the Civil War came out, and the man was shot dead the first day of the Civil War. And these are things that sort of amaze me about these people. I didn't set out to make them heroes. One woman sent me in an email, said, "You set out to make them all heroes," she said, "because there was the killing of the actor in Merrion Square or whatever, who wouldn't loan the guys, give them his cart. He brought around his scenery on a cart, and they wanted to put up a road blockade, and he wouldn't give them the cart, so they shot him dead. That's fair enough, I left that out. But I also left out the murder of Sheehy Skeffington, who was a great pacifist. And that guy spent all his time trying to persuade the volunteers to give it up, because he hated violence. And he was coming home to Rathmines one evening. He was stopped by a British patrol. There was some captain who just didn't like the look of him or whatever. Brought him in, brought him out and shot him the next day with some other man. So I tried to be fair.
If you were to try to, you know, even do a fairly comprehensive, a mildly comprehensive overview of the whole thing,
you'd need about 4 1916.
Yeah. I mean, what page count did you have?
I had 48 pages.
48 pages.
Ridiculous.
I think they were very cautious, weren't they?
They were very cautious. They're very small, and they just, when I says, look, we need twice that number, I was just told, Jerry, there's a word, discipline. You got to learn to discipline yourself. And I said, yes, boss.
No other writer would be expected to summarise, you know, something like that. No publisher would say, yeah, okay, write us a 1916 book, you've only got 48 pages,
well,
off you go.
I think it comes across in the thing. It's a criticism I have of the comic. If I'm criticising the odd one, some of the pages are far too many panels. So they're small.
Well, I think it was, they were, as far as they were concerned, they were dipping their toe into you know, completely unknown territory, if I can mix my metaphors. And so you can't blame them. Sure, it could always be done again. You could always go back and do, you know.
No, let someone else go back and do it again.
The 1916 edition, the 2016 edition of the 1916 graphic novel.
Yeah.
But, okay,
actually,
now,
some fella came on to me, and he had a great idea, and he was talking about 1916, and they had an idea, right? There were two or three of them, and they were getting together to produce something, and this is all way above my head, far is it Twitter or whatever these things are. But they wanted to redo 1916, but to give the boys modern day weapons, to up it all, update the whole thing. And I says, good luck to you. Keep it up. You know, fire ahead. And they sort of said, does that mean you're not in? No, I said, I'm not in.
Anyway, I'm going to ask to see if the audience have any questions shortly. But seeing as you set out, you know, when you retired, and you set out and you gave yourself your 10 years to teach yourself how to do this and so on, how do you feel now about how it's all gone?
I think I've been very lucky. I think I came in at a stage where there was a huge, as I said, and as I keep emphasizing, a huge upsurge in the talent, in the quality of Irish comics.
Mm-hmm.
From what I saw sort of like 25 years ago, mm-hmm. when I used to go into the comic shops, and some of the lads, and very good luck to them, and I hope some of them have kept at it, for having the courage to bring in their small comics, maybe 10 pages, and good luck to a fellow like Kevin and Rob Corley and these guys for actually giving them space to sell them. Now, I think it's gone terrific since that time, and I think I have been very lucky in that I came on just when things were hotting up.
Well, you were part of what was that process, I think.
And all I have to say about it is, it's a lonely life drawing comics, I can tell you, mm-hmm. if you're there all day, and if you're as slow as I am, and if you're working up maybe 11 o'clock at night, 7 days a week, mm-hmm. and you're not really talking to anybody, you get up to the pub for a couple of pints, and that's the end of it. But, having said that, some of the guys I've met, the lads we've mentioned here, who are the comic artists and the guys who sell the comics and that, you couldn't meet nicer. And we're not, there's no jealousy, there's no nothing. We all help each other out. We all tell each other this, that, and the other. I mean, when Alan Nolan was gone, he was thinking of tying up with O'Brien Press, he was asking her, I gave him names and that.
Mm.
But anyone would do that. They give a guy a name. There was no such thing as, oh God, this guy is going to impinge on my pitch. Not at all. You don't do that. If you're good enough, you'll get there. Yeah. You'll get there.
Fair enough. Does anybody have any questions? You're all happy and... good grief.
you were talking about Frank Hart there. Would you adapt any like folklore? You know, instead of doing history, would you maybe adapt Irish folk tales into...
It's funny you should ask me that one. O'Brien Press had an idea way back, well, a couple of years back when I was doing the first one for them. They had an idea of, what was it? I don't know, was it James Joyce or someone like that, taking a ramble around Dublin and meeting various characters, not so much from his own era, maybe from previous eras, and seeing what sort of conversations they'd have. But it seems to have fallen through. I mean, I was prepared to listen, but as regards doing... Are you talking about actual folk heroes, like...
Folk tales. Adapting folk tales, kind of...
I don't see it happening in the near future. I don't see it happening in the near future, because O'Brien Press were asking me to do something about the famine.
So they want kind of educational.
They want educational stuff.
Yeah.
And as well as that, the famine is something I would only use it as a start. It was an awful thing.
Yeah.
But let's face it, it was just an awful... What could you say about it?
Mm.
You know, it was just people dying by the wayside, not being able to get food. So I had thought about it, and I had done a few sketches for them, and then I kept thinking about the War of Independence. But what I was going to do is, I was only going to use the famine as a start, maybe the first three pages, and get a family to emigrate because of the famine. And then the whole comic would be about their life in America, and whether they got on or whether they didn't get on, or that sort of thing. But I don't know. I don't see it happening.
Mm.
Not for me.
I think there's plenty of individual episodes in Irish history that have a huge amount of potential as they are.
Yeah,
I mean, as you say,
it's not a folk tale, but if I ever was thinking along those lines, there's one I would love to do, and that would be Patrick Sarsfield. Because it would be a different era, it'd have different weapons, but again, it would be a question of fighting against the British Empire.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. But I haven't thought about it. I have to say to you, I haven't thought about it all that much.
Do you do a lot of research for things like costume and weapons and stuff like that?
No.
No. Just make it up.
It's a simple answer. I mean, I hear people, it took me 6 years to research this. I usually get it done in about 3 weeks, I have to tell you. Because what is there to research?
Well, do you want
you mean, who do you talk to?
Well, I mean, you know, would you go looking for pictures, photo reference and things like that, or of you know, this
well,
is what
I'd
most people look
to the National Library.
Oh, well, that's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, but I'd spend a day there.
Yeah. That's fair enough.
It's a day, and that's it. But, you see, usually if when it comes to doing stuff like that, you're not given much time. I admire these people who spend years researching stuff. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it.
I don't know why I am writing a book myself, and I have to say sometimes I think the research is the best bit.
You
for
enjoy
me.
It. Well, then, some,
you know, and although you do end up being dragged off in all directions, and you follow something, you know, it's really not terribly relevant, but it's just too interesting to not to.
I have to say, I prefer doing something now, and this is why I'll be delighted when I get the War of Independence finished and get back to doing stuff where I make it up.
Yeah. It's, well, that's the thing.
Make it up fiction.
You're a writer, and. But you're writing fiction, and you're also, if you like, writing or reinterpreting what history. And but you're also an artist. I mean, if you could only pick one or the other, if you could only be a writer or only be an artist.
Oh, I'm a hopeless writer. I really.
You're not doing
I
too badly.
No, I would love to get someone to write a good story for me. But having said that, I would probably be very hard to please, and that's probably why I'm stuck with myself when it comes to writing. But I'd much prefer drawing.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I can draw all day.
Yeah.
As I do.
As you do, indeed.
So that's it.
Fair enough. Now it's quarter to. Does anybody have anything?
So you were saying you got in contact with Brian Lee for colouring in comics.
Yes.
How did that come about? Like, were you the word that you were looking for a colourist, or how did it work?
It was actually Gas. Brian Lee had produced a comic. He was one of about six artists, young artists, who came together to produce a comic, very ambitious, called, would you believe, Toenail Clippings. And he, one of them, a fellow called, Stephen Weeks, he was another very good colourist. And I got to know Stephen, don't ask me how, I just got to know him. And when Toenail Clippings went to the wall, the only email address I had, the only contact I had for Stephen Weeks was this email I had, and I sent him a query wanting to know would he be interested in colouring a comic for me. And he had seen some of my stuff. We had met maybe in Sub City or Forbidden Planet or someplace like that, and we just got talking. And I got an email back from Bren D saying, well, I was the colourist of Toenail Clippings, and if you wouldn't mind sort of me sort of robbing this little spot, I'll meet you. And we met in Messrs. Maguire's, if you ever want to try some nice new beer. And we had a chat about it, and and he's a guy who's gone on terrific now. I mean, he does these things down in, the last one was in New York too. The theatre. He gets all
Offset,
these,
yes, exactly.
He gets all these well-known artists from all over the world, and he's going terrific now. But he has done them all. The only problem now is that he's getting so busy that I don't know whether he'll be able to do any more for me. Which is a pity, but that's the way it goes.
And you wouldn't colour things yourself, just to keep for...
No, would you believe... I am almost colourblind.
Oh.
I'm very bad on colour. And I cannot colour on a computer, which you have to be able to do now. You've got to have someone... I mean, when I see the Bren B doing stuff on the computer with the colouring, I just decide, it's like everything else, leave it to the guy who knows how to do it best. Leave it to the experts. And that's what I do. I concentrate on the drawing. And I don't make any... When I did in Dublin City... And in Dublin City too, I coloured my own cover because I knew no one at the time. I mean, as Parry can tell you, the first print I did of Dublin City one was 25 pages, which I stapled myself and brought them down and got them sold. So I had to colour it myself. And it's only since then that I've got to know all these people. But it's difficult to get a good colourist. And... I'm always anxious to know.
I must say, I saw somebody at something recently, and he this interview, what he was doing, he was very, very good. I'll talk to you about it again.
Oh, very good.
But
very good.
Now, before I wind up, is there anything else we want to say? When's the next? What's coming out next?
I would hope that Draugr will be coming out next, as soon as I can get someone to do the cover. And it's funny, some of these guys who are well known, and I'm talking about really well known fellas, you write to them, and after about 5 emails, they eventually get back to you and say, sure, I'd be delighted to do a cover for you, as if they knew you all their life. And one of them did that to me, and he says, could you tell me, he was very businesslike, could you tell me whether you want a black and white, when you want it, and then we can discuss the cost. I was over the moon, and I sent him back all the buff, and I've also sent him about, and that's about 5 months ago, I've also sent him about 4 emails, and I haven't had another word from him. So that's what you're dealing with when you're dealing with some of these well-known guys. It depends on how things are going for them. But as soon as I get that done, I'll have it out, and I would hope to have it out within the next month.
Oh, great. Is that...
That's assuming I get the cover done. It could be 3 months.
Are you publishing that yourself?
Yeah.
Very good.
Oh, I'm doing that myself, because I don't think I'm going to twist O'Brien Press's arm on that one. They don't like to see girls having shower. They obviously feel like my mother, that when a girl has a shower, she should have these like long johns on her, like what they used to wear going into the sea for the swim.
Oh yes.
But mine don't, unfortunately.
I should just nothing wrong with that, really.
No.
Okay, Jerry, thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you. I enjoy that.